Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start the show today by talking with you about prostate cancer. Men with a diagnosis of prostate cancer face a choice between commencing treatment with radiation or surgery, or maybe opting for actively monitoring the disease. And according to the latest studies, their long-term survival may not be affected by any of those choices. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along again. Our guest, Dr. Greg Cooley, clinical associate professor in the Department of Human Ecology at the UW Health. And he's participated in delivering remarkable advances in the evolution, the imaging, surveillance, and treatment of patients with prostate cancer, and he's done it over the last couple of decades. And he's going to share what he knows about the different options for dealing with prostate cancer and, of course, answer your questions as well about prevention and treatment. Maybe you've navigated this tough choice already between invasive treatment or just monitoring your condition. What was the outcome of that? I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Dr. Greg Cooley, welcome. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you very much for having me on the show, and I'm pleased to be able to talk to your audience about this fire hose of information that's been coming out lately in prostate cancer. So.
Well, yeah, you take a look at the New York Times. They reported on this new study that indicates that the long-term survival rate for men with, if you have early prostate diagnosis, could be the same whether you opt for treatment or with surgery or radiation or whether you just actively monitor their condition. Tell us about this study.
Right. Doesn't that make things confusing for any one individual? And you, depending on the doctor you see, you might get a different interpretation, right? And I was really pleased just a month or two ago with my very fine primary care physician who asked my opinion about whether I want to get a PSA and why I would. And having the opportunity to have that discussion is really important. Of course, knowing what I know might have been a little different than, you know, asking the average layperson who says, well, geez, I don't know, doc, what should I do? And, you know, one of the places that I like to start, and I did with my primary care physician, is you're absolutely right. I think everybody, or at least most people, recognize the fact that we have an awful lot of low-risk prostate cancers that don't need treatment. And to be honest with you, most of those guys I haven't treated since the early 2000s, because even by that point, we were starting to see that, gosh, if you follow these guys for, you know, 10, maybe even 15 years, you don't see any survival difference. You might see some local progression problems, more, you know, urinary issues that might have to be addressed. But yet, you know, how do we find the guys that have the small percentage high-risk cancers in which there is a real mortality? It was just a few years ago I was telling a patient, while more screening was being done, that, you know, we have about 240,000 diagnoses per year. That's not necessarily treatment, just diagnoses. And about 28,000 guys are dying of this prostate cancer. So, you know, it's a huge difference. Who are the ones that are going to get in trouble? And so we actually have the information to help discern that, but unfortunately it's not perfect. Happy to report, though, that it's getting a lot better. And in fact, just this year in 2017, the American Joint Committee on Cancer, the AJCC, along with the European UICC, have updated the staging criteria because, frankly, what we've been using for the last few decades has been so imprecise that it mixes all these groups of patients together. And so it makes it troublesome. And one of the concerns that I have moving forward, too, is that you may or may not have in the newspapers read about the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. This is a very influential group, primarily composed of primary care physicians, very smart people, of course, who looked at the data and back in 2012 came out and said, you know what, we're giving PSA screening a D. You don't need to do it based on the data that we've looked at. Well, you know, the problem with the data is one that they kind of made some serious errors in mixing three different data sets together. The one from the U.S. was from the prostate, lung, colon, and ovarian screening trial. And the idea in this trial was to try and determine if screening made a difference. The Europeans had a very similar trial, and these were the two primary trials looked at. There was a third trial that's not often mentioned from Sweden called, I believe it's pronounced the Gutenberg trial. But in the U.S. trial, what turns out is it wasn't really a method of screening versus not screening, because in the non-screening group, at least in one report recently published, 90% of the men had PSAs within 1 to 2 years before the screening. And what we know about PSA screening now is that you may not even need to screen more often than that. So essentially what it came down to was a trial comparing people that were screened every year versus those that were screened less frequently. And as you might expect, the results weren't any different.
You can see that. I have to tell you, I have a family history of prostate cancer, so I'm one of these people who wants to have that PSA test.
Yeah, and that's what the European trial showed. You know, in those countries, there really wasn't a systematic screening, and so in that particular group of patients, the start of or initiation of screening did actually see a small mortality benefit. And likewise, in the studies that have compared observation to surgery for earlier stage patients, again, in this country, you know, no survival difference. But there in that country, indeed, there is a small mortality benefit. If you compare the two groups of patients, this group in the U.S. where we've had this screening going on, we typically had smaller prostates, non-palpable disease, just primarily identified by PSA. But in the European studies, of course, they found palpable larger nodules. And, of course, we know the stage shifting that occurs from that, you know, means that they're further along in the course of their therapy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of point number one, really, is that the recommendations, unfortunately, weren't made on sound science. And so then the next step is, okay, well, that still doesn't answer the problem. If we find somebody with prostate cancer, then who should we treat and who should be watched?
Right.
So basically there, the issue comes down to some really important traditional factors that we looked at. And then more recently, there's some very dramatic shifts in the way we both approach looking for these cancers and defining who's higher risk and lower risk. And so those are some of the things that are going to really help us sort out who really needs treatment and who doesn't.
Yeah. John in Elkhorn has a question. Let's go there. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call, John. What's on your mind today?
Well, okay, just real briefly, I was diagnosed after never really having a PSA test on my birthday, of all things, back in June of 2015. Shocking. Nonetheless, I went in and was evaluated, and we decided to go with the radiation/anti-hormonal
treatment.
Mm-hmm. Does that sound right, doctor?
Sure does, sure.
Okay, so I've been successful. I mean, a couple big shots of anti-hormonal. My PSA went down, and then we went with a month and a half of radiation. My question is the shots that I've been given, it's maybe a two-point question. The shots that I was given were a thing called Lupron. And I actually think that, you know, just think of it, anti-hormonal.
Mm-hmm.
It does a lot to your body that you are probably thinking. It made me what I'd say is soft. I think that I've had weight gain with it. And then the second part is that this is only a two-year treatment. Does that make sense to you? You know, where after 2 years, we no longer have the shots, and then we just monitor.
Yes, absolutely. So, John, one of the things that I'm sure that they looked at, whether they talked to you about it, I don't know, but obviously the first part of your diagnosis was the PSA followed by the prostate biopsies. From those prostate biopsies, the most important information we get is what's called the Gleason score. So
right.
Dr. Gleason was a VA pathologist in the 60s who looked at a lot of prostatectomy specimens and came up with this system of basically giving them a beauty score, or in this case, an ugly score. And today, we find this to be one of the most reliable pieces of information for the separation between active surveillance and treatment. And then within the treatment categories, of course, pretty much closing in on the particular type of treatment you described. And essentially, the Gleason score typically ranges from 6 to 10. Could you have something lower? Yes, but most people are almost not even recognizing Gleason 6 as cancer, although that's markedly debatable because of the fact that we see some of these patients progress to higher stages. But they are the ones that we typically would offer observation to. But the Gleason score is made up of two numbers, and so if you have a 6, that means you have a 3, which is what they saw most of, a 3, which is what they saw second most of. So you can have a 3 and a 4, a 4 and a 3, a 4 and a 5, all the way up to a 5 and a 5. And basically what we know now is that the higher the number, the more risk producing the cancer is, and the more chance both for local progression and for spread into the bones, which is what becomes the lethal event. So back in the 70s and 80s, we found that, gosh, we've been using hormones to temporarily shrink it in patients with metastatic disease. This anti-hormone that you talked about, the Lupron, what it does is it tells your brain to tell the testicles to stop making so much testosterone. And for whatever reason, prostate cancers tend to feed on testosterone. So when they're widely metastatic, it will put them in remission for a while. But in the 70s and 80s, what we found was that, gosh, the hormones are not only helping those guys, they're actually seeming to help make the radiation a more effective disease by making the cancer cells more sensitive to the radiation that we were giving. And of course, relative to that time period, we are using so much more dose, so much more safely now, that we're actually having to reevaluate how much hormone, if any hormone, because we're finding that since the primary benefit of the hormone seems to be helping get rid of the prostate cancer, the question is at what dose do we still need to do that? So the recommendations that I'm sure that you were made on were based on the fact that you might have had some risk factors that suggested, you know, we definitely shouldn't watch this, and, you know, it usually implies a higher Gleason score. By no means means you're incurable. It just means they're throwing the book at you, if you will. You want to try and do everything you can to eradicate it the first time so that you don't have to worry about it in the past, you know, in the future. So one of the things that I do in addition to external beam is brachytherapy. Brachytherapy is a version of putting radiation from the inside. Larry, I wouldn't make it on your Saturday morning gardening program because I sometimes joke with my patients, I do no-growth gardening. I plant seeds hoping nothing grows. So,
oh, boy.
Yeah, some laugh, some don't. But the idea, though, is that, you know, with the older style radiation, we could get as much dose in as we can today. And so as we've been able to accelerate the doses, both with external beam radiation, as you received, John, but also with these additional boosting of the implanted seeds, either a permanent type of seed or a temporary seeding called high-dose rate implant, that we are achieving doses higher than we ever thought possible. And when we're looking at the data, we're starting to wonder, gosh, do we need to use any hormone? Some of the data suggests no. Some of the data, depending on risk groups, suggests yes. So in the external beam world, because we are using higher doses and because we fear taking too far a step backwards, we want to say, you know, from the historical data, we know that this 2 years of hormones is better than not, and in some groups better than, say, 4 to 6 months of hormones. And we have some ongoing studies right now that unfortunately are going to take a matter of years before we can, you know, get the results. But up until then, you know, we feel it's best to follow that older data for the hormone use.
There we go. All right.
Okay. Real quickly, though, I mean, I had my last anti-hormonal shot about a month and a half ago. It should probably, I'm not scheduled to have any more, and I'm assuming then the shot will dwindle out of my body somewhere mid-summer. I mean, I shouldn't be looking at an internal placement of anything in my body or anything.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. That would have been planned ahead of time and with the idea of, you know, moving forward in that direction. And so, but you will probably find that it will take a while for that that testosterone reversal, even though you might feel better sooner in terms of, you know, I call them menopausal symptoms because they're very much like menopausal. I'm sure, John, you may have experienced some of that. Like you said, body fat redistribution, hot flashes, you know, sweats, a sense of fatigue even. And you can often tell when the testosterone's coming back as that stuff dissipates. But in the studies where they followed the testosterone, it can take quite a bit longer than the end of that time period for that to recover. So don't be surprised if it takes a little longer. But hopefully you'll be one of the lucky ones and bounce back, like you said, by summer.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you so much for calling, John. Appreciate your call. Dr. Greg Cooley, our guest today, clinical associate professor in the Department of Human Oncology at UW Health, talking with him about prostate cancer. I'm Larry Mueller. Joel Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll be taking a look at the science, the politics, and the human cost of developing vaccines. That's at 11:45, so stay with us for that. And stay with us for our current guest, Dr. Greg Cooley, a clinical associate professor in the Department of Human Oncology at the University of Wisconsin, as we talk with him about prostate cancer. Questions, join in at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And let's turn to Bob in New Berlin next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I just got done with the external beam radiation in December, and on my own, I just went and had another PSA test. My first one was 18, and since I had radiation, like just last week, I had another PSA test. It's down to 6 now.
That's great. That's that early after the completion of treatment is a fine drop. There isn't any one absolute percentage velocity, if you will, in the drop that makes a difference. The ultimate importance is how low it drops and then does it stay down there. And so, you know, you're in that's a perfectly good result at this early point.
Yep. But yeah, my Gleason scores were from 7 to 8.
Okay. And then the PSA. So they how long do they have you on the hormones for?
I opted out of those. I didn't take those.
Oh, okay. And so you're doing well thus far?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is some side effects, but I didn't really want the surgery either. So
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are all things that are really important to consider, you know, is in balancing both active surveillance and, you know, the side effects and then, of course, the long-term risks of treatment. There are a lot of things. In the active surveillance world, as much as we try to push folks into that, there's a couple of things we have to deal with, not the least of which is that, at least currently, they recommend annual repeat biopsies. And I think the best example of the trouble with that comes from an MD Anderson urologist that I listened to in a panel session last year, and you know, these are the guys that do the prostate biopsies. He said to the general audience, "If I ever need my prostate biopsied, you're putting me out for it." So it's not always a painless procedure, and you know, with doing that, there's always a small risk, a 1% risk or so, of getting a serious infection. And yeah, I've had a number of guys who, after a couple of times of that, say, "You know what, doc? I just assume treat this and be done with these biopsies." One of the exciting advancements, though, that we're right in the crux of this change, I think, is there's a couple of things going on. You know, we were talking with John before about, you know, first you get those biopsies after the PSA, and the standard right now is to get biopsies from top to bottom, left to right, generally 10 to 12 needle biopsies. Sometimes that picks up the cancer, and other times it comes up negative, even though, you know, the PSA is elevated. One of the tools that's become incredibly useful for us in the last few years is MRI. You know, we've talked in the past about CTs and bone scans, and the reality is they're highly imperfect tests. And in fact, CT really only shows you the external anatomy of the prostate and the size of the lymph nodes, but it doesn't actually tell you what's going on inside. One of the really nice things about MRI is that it doesn't see the low-risk Gleason cancers well, like the Gleason 6, but what it does see well generally is the higher, uglier ones. So to have a test in which you find the cancers you want to treat and don't find the cancers you don't want could be a really good thing. And some places are starting, it's still, you know, in the early phases, is not necessarily doing the systemic 10 to 12 biopsies, but getting an MRI and doing targeted biopsies on whatever looks ugly. The advantage of that, of course, is that you're not going to be finding those smaller risk prostate cancers and then having the poor gentleman worrying about that when there's little need to, but you will have a better selection of those folks with a higher risk where then you can address the treatment to and actually offer them more accurate treatment choices as well based on that. So then if you end up with a gentleman that is on active surveillance, his PSA is elevated, maybe they didn't find anything, or maybe they did find a nodule, and maybe it was a very small nodule with, say, a Gleason 3, 4, or a Gleason 7 with a low PSA. This is a guy that you could very well go for a couple years, maybe rescan with an MRI, watch the PSA. If it doesn't change much, there's a lot more peace of mind that you're not missing something deeper. And then that MRI, for those guys that do need treated, can be very helpful to a radiation oncologist because, particularly, I know in the implant world, we always, with every therapy, we generally treat the whole prostate. But we have the ability then to put, if you will, it's like picture within a picture on a TV. It's dose within a dose in the prostate. And whether that's with external beam or with the implant boost, you can actually accelerate the dose into the areas you want it without risking the surrounding structures such as bladder, rectum, urethra, and things like that. In fact, my colleague, Dr. Ritter, has an SBRT program, which is an accelerated prostate trial in which five fractions are given. And there's five-year data that looks quite good on this, but in higher-risk patients, we still don't have all the answers, and so one of the goals is to try and accelerate doses into the visible nodules, keeping the dose to the surrounding areas down, and I have a really strong suspicion that this is going to further improve our already good results for the higher-risk patients.
Yeah. What are the downsides of radiation and surgery?
Sure. In the broad categories, I think the biggest things that gentlemen come in with on the worry side of things. Obviously, with surgery, the concern is always incontinence. I would think overwhelmingly that's risk number one. I think the second one, particularly in younger men, is the potential risk for loss of erections. And, you know, there are pros and cons for both therapies. But in the big world, incontinence is, you know, on the order of 5 to 10% risk with surgery, and it's not very much of a risk with radiation. Radiation has more of the opposite problem, which is you're worried about causing urinary obstructive symptoms since the urine canal is running, you know, through the prostate. Having said that, we've had such literally marked improvement in technological advances in radiation that, you know, even studies that are now just being published are almost outdated once they get to their 10 years because things have advanced beyond that. So, you know, machines now routinely have image guidance. What does that mean? That means that literally live, right prior to your treatment, you can have a CAT scan that lines your prostate up to less than a millimeter accuracy, or you can put fiducials, these little tiny gold seeds in the prostate if you wanted to. You don't need to, but you actually can live image as the treatment's going on. If the fiducials in the prostate move at all, meaning the prostate moves, machine automatically cuts off. What does that do? Well, that basically means we can make radiation fields extremely tightly marginated, unlike the old days where you only had to line up to skin surfaces, and so you had to make the fields bigger to account for that movement. That's part of the reason that we go so much higher in dose now and in a shorter period of time than in the old days. You know, the standard of care here at UW-Madison is a 5.5 week course of radiation that's equivalent to about 8 to 9 weeks of the traditional standard therapy because of that very precision. And in Europe, it's technique that they've been using actually longer, I would say, than we have, given their more limited resources. And, you know, the toxicities aren't any worse. So those are the big things. In the world of erections, MRI is another very useful tool for that. Dr. McLaughlin, who's up at the University of Michigan, has been really educating a lot of both radiation oncologists and urologists about the fact that when you look at MRIs, you can actually see the erection nerves. And in about half of the folks, these nerves come down the back outer side of the prostate like cables. And in the other half, they're more almost spray painted on the prostate. Well, if you're a surgeon, it's very easy to remove cables that are exterior to the prostate, but if they're intertwined on the edge, then you have to worry about leaving some of the prostate tissue behind and thus, you know, recurring prostate cancer. And so that's another tool that I think is somewhat in its infancy for that. With external beam and in hormonal therapy, we tend to have the highest rate of erection loss, and with the brachytherapy alone, we probably have I'd say most studies say that we have the lowest rate of erection loss on the order of about 14 to 40%. We're starting to learn what the causes of that are. Right below the prostate is the penile bulb, and there are valuable vessels and nerves that supply erections that come from there. And off to the side of the prostate, there are arteries called the internal pudendal artery. All of the data seems to show that if you start pulling in the doses away from those, that the erection function is better maintained. So those are some of the big issues, and we're making great progress in all those areas.
Excellent. Mike in Baraboo has something for us. Mike, hello. Thank you for calling. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was just calling in. I've had the PSA test, and it was at 7.4. The doctor recommended, well, we put me on Cipro for a month, two tablets a day, one in the morning, one in the evening, and brought my PSA down to 4.3. Scheduled for a biopsy this afternoon. And just wondering what your thoughts are on the PSA reading that I have had.
Mike, can I ask how old you are?
I'm 70.
Okay.
70 this year.
Sure. So, yeah, so, you know, it's a little elevated. I presume you must have had some fluctuation in your PSA in the past, or is this the first time that it jumped up like that?
We didn't have it. I haven't had the test real often. I can't ever recall. It's been a long time since I had the PSA.
Mm.
And how it was this time, I was in to the doctor for some other things, and they were doing some blood work, and I said, well, why don't we just do the PSA test? So he did, and it came back at 7.4. He was a little shocked.
Yeah.
And then he put me on the Cipro, and that brought it down to 4.3. And like I say, I'm scheduled for a biopsy.
Okay, sure. Yeah, you know, this is an interesting topic because back in 2003, I had a gentleman who had gone from 7 to 17. And, you know, it's pretty rare to have an infection in the prostate, and it's also pretty rare for prostate cancers to jump up like that. You know, you might normally see a PSA, somebody with prostate cancer, double every 2 to 3 years or so, rarely a year, but not certainly in one level. And one of the things that's interesting about men's prostates is they sometimes seem to get inflamed or irritated, and they don't even know they have it. And, you know, you may have heard, well, PSAs aren't accurate. Well, part of the reason for that is that any inflammation in the gland, whether it's felt or not, can cause a temporary jump in your PSA. I had seen an awful lot of guys being treated with antibiotics with no effect on that PSA, but on maybe 1 out of 5 patients starting in about 2003, this isn't in any textbook, so, you know, we're off the record here. But
okay.
But, you know, I thought, well, gosh, if inflammation is causing this poor gentleman's PSA to go up and down and up and down and making everybody nervous, what if we give him anti-inflammatory for 2 weeks? And so first we started with ibuprofen, and then we went to Aleve. Well, in that particular gentleman, he went right from 17 back down to 7, and so we took him out of an intermediate risk category into a low risk if he had prostate cancer, and indeed he did. But it was only a single biopsy focus of a Gleason 6, and we said, you know what, you don't need to treat this, we'll just watch that. So, it's, you know, you're 70, and if you're in good health, I think it's this is the point, I think, where the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force recommendations fail, and that is that if we don't look for it, sure, the incidence of cancer goes down, and sure, we're not treating unnecessary ones as much, but we're also not finding the guys that really do need treatment, the ones that are really at risk for mortality-related, prostate cancer mortality. And so what you do with those biopsy information is, one, we know your PSA isn't very elevated because it wouldn't have come down to 4.3 if it wasn't. Two, if we do find cancer, then what's really important is not only the Gleason score in terms of, you know, is it a 3-3, 3-4, 4-3. The first number represents what they see the most of, so that's the most important thing. But other factors that aren't currently in the staging system that are really important that really reflect the amount of cancer, and there is what percentage of the biopsies are positive. So if it's less than 50%, you know, that's lower risk if it's more. In fact, the NCCN guidelines for this say that if you have 2 or fewer positive biopsies, you're in the very low-risk category with a Gleason 6. You know, you don't want to treat that. You just watch it. And likewise, even for the low-risk patients, which, again, are Gleason 6, but have maybe 3 or more positive biopsies. But, you know, then over time, you watch the PSA and look for the rate of rise and that kind of thing. And that can help guide you very safely. In fact, you know, that Sweden study that I mentioned to you, the Gothenburg trial, that trial was actually patients that were actively surveilled, and then if they progressed, they treated them, and they had a 44% mortality reduction. So it showed that you can watch folks safely and then treat them if necessary.
We thank you so much for that call, Mike. I appreciate it. We had Robert email to ask if ejaculation within a day prior to a PSA test has an effect on the PSA test result.
Actually, you know, that interestingly enough, that's been measured, and yes, there is a little bit of influence. It seems within about 2 days that it goes back to baseline, catheterization, you know, somebody needs a Foley catheter could do it. A very vigorous, you know, prostate exam, pushing down too hard, and it can cause subtle changes. But in general, they're not very big changes, and so, you know, it wouldn't be a marked difference.
Gerald in Rhinelander has something for us. Hi, Gerald. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My PSAs have been sort of bouncing around between 5 and 7, sometimes up, sometimes down. And the doctor's kind of taking a wait-and-see attitude. But I'm confused now with this talk about Gleason scores. What's the correlation between PSAs and Gleason's, and how does a Gleason require a biopsy?
That's a great question. So, yeah, there is some correlation, but this is going to get this is a little unusual. So if you had to compare the prognostication of a Gleason score, which is how ugly the cancer looks under the microscope, compared to the PSA level, the PSA level is less of a risk. Recent studies have actually shown, in fact, that, you know, when you go from a Gleason, you cross the 10 border, you go from a 9 to 11 on the Gleason, or I'm sorry, on the PSA, that doesn't influence a change in prognosis as much as the pathology or the Gleason score. So if you have a Gleason score of 6 and you're up at a 12, well, you've gone from low risk to intermediate risk, but the recent data suggests if you don't have a lot of cancer in there, that your prognosis is actually no worse. So the Gleason score, the PSA is the first thing to tell us, should you be biopsied? Then once you're biopsied, the Gleason score says, how ugly is the cancer and what's the chance of it getting us into trouble? And, you know, it's the Gleason 8 to 10 group in particular that at the beginning when I was talking about who's really at risk for dying of this cancer, that's the risk group where you really want to focus on and find those one and treat those ones, even in a healthy 70-year-old, because there's the potential for a real 5-year mortality. That was actually even shown in a study that's just being published, actually in a couple of places, one from UCLA and one from University of Pittsburgh, both of which are large epidemiologic studies, but they still point to the same thing that some of the smaller, newer studies are showing, which is that, you know, we're getting much better PSA control, particularly with the highest doses that we can get combining external beam and implant for the high-risk guys, and we're actually getting results that are as good or better than surgery, certainly as good when you combine surgery with postoperative radiation. So, you know, in your case, Gerald, the fact that your PSA has been fluctuating in the 5 to 7 range is somewhat reassuring, because if it's kind of going up and down and, you know, bouncing around in that area, we're not seeing a steady uprise that would suggest there's something growing.
There we go. Thank you so much, Gerald. Sean in St. Paul, Minnesota, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
So I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. I had a PSA test when I turned 50 that indicated a low but slightly elevated level, so my doctor recommended a biopsy. Biopsy came back with a small amount of cancer in one core.
Okay.
And I opted for a watchful waiting program.
Great.
Had a second biopsy that came back with a non-detect. And 3 years after my initial diagnosis, I had a third biopsy that indicated a little bit higher, a Gleason 7 in one of the cores. My doctor then had me take some kind of a genetic test that came in at the lowest level. I also had an MRI that showed, again, at the lowest level.
Great.
Based solely on the Gleason score increase, my doctor recommended surgery. So I went to, at that point, I went to the Mayo Clinic for a second opinion, and their review of the biopsy slides confirmed that the Gleason score had increased. And again, based solely on the review of the biopsy slides, they had a prostatectomy. the lab results that came back from the prostatectomy indicate there was no Gleason 7, that there was only, the low amount of Gleason 6 cancer.
Okay.
So, my comment is beware of the biopsy, reading of the biopsy results, because they can be wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did your PSA do just before the surgery? Did that change much?
It was up a little bit. It was never, I think it was the highest it ever was an 8.
Okay, sure. Yeah, there's no question, and that's something I often talk to patients about too. Is that when you're looking at studies, we know that there's both an upgrading and a downgrading. More often than not, it's an upgrading, but it does happen in the other direction. And I get particularly worried when you have only a single core, because you're looking at something microscopically that, honestly, is based on the architecture of the, it's not the individual cells, it's how the cells form these tubes. And when you have that little tissue, it can be very challenging. That's where they describe the art of pathology reading. So I think that's a really good point. I think in part that's also in the NCCN guidelines. They do include folks such as you in that, well, you can continue active surveillance in this group, but, just be careful because it is the Gleason 7 group that can have a small, in fact, a recent trial comparing active surveillance to surgery to radiation did show in the active surveillance group that a small percentage of Gleason 7 patients out to 10 years do have distant metastasis, but you didn't have that, This is the challenging part of our job. You had everything done right. You had the MRI, the biopsies, but, it isn't always a perfect science for sure.
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Sean. And Jim and Nasita, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah. So far, I haven't heard anybody really other than this past fellow here. I had the RP done. I'm going to be 59 in June. I had the RP done. It'll be 2 years in April. I found out in November of 2014 from a health network that my PSA level was elevated. I never would have known this. My wife's a nurse, and it was a 9.3. She had me check into it. So I was right here at UW Clinics in Boston, and I was set up with Dr. Sean Hedekin. You're probably familiar with him, and you're on. And we went through quite a few things there, discussions and whatnot, and he had suggested the removal of the prostate. My Gleason was a 7, and I was a little concerned, and I asked him about the radiation, possibly, and he said, well, sure, you can get set up with some of that. He says, but there's upsides and the downsides. It could work out well. The downside is that with the robotic, at least he has the opportunity to have the nerve-sparing surgery, and we're opposed with the radiation. If that does, the chances of with the radiation of coming back were greater than having it removed. So I'm a little confused on that part right there, because once, if it does come back after radiation, then there was no way of doing the nerve sparing surgery. I guess the point I'm trying to make here is I'm just about 2 years out. I just seen him last week for the last time. I'm still part of the Zero Club. So it's been
very good.
Yeah, it's been undetectable. My big thing is, I did gain some weight, a lot of fatigue. The incontinence was it lasted probably about a year. It wasn't all the time. And now it's just so sporadic, it's not funny. But the biggest problem has been, a lot of it has been, like, it's the ED, and I don't know, it's like I say, at my age here, going to be 59. I feel like it affects my, I don't have the energy I used to, and I don't have any desires, and it just seems...
The lower, yeah. You want to comment on that, Dr. Cooley?
Yeah, these are the challenges that every man faces, is like, what is the best treatment for me? And there, kind of at the beginning, we were talking about all the different treatment options. If I may plug a website that is out there for prostate cancer men, there is a group of docs that was founded by a recently deceased Peter Grimm, who was one of the founders of the prostate seed implants done out in Seattle. And with a large panel of urologists, radiation oncologists across the country, they decided to go through all of the 48,000 plus articles on prostate cancer, and basically said, let's just look at the articles that have 5 years of data, at least with a median follow-up of 5 years, have at least 100 patients to make it statistically significant, and in reputable journals so that, you know, that they've been peer-reviewed properly. By the time they did that, they've down to about 223 articles, and they looked at every possible treatment, both the old-style and new-style radical prostatectomy, external beam plus or minus hormones. They even had the few articles on cryotherapy and the opposite HIFU, which there are very few on, proton therapy, and then all forms of radiation, external, high-dose rate implant, low-dose rate, plus or minus hormones. The website is pctrf.org, and on that website, you could go and take your risk factors, your Gleason score, and your stage, your fingers, and you can look at these graphs for low, intermediate, and high-risk patients. Very easy to find out which risk group you're in, and you can actually see what's been published as in terms of the results of all of these different therapies, because, you know, you have to weigh, like you said, the pros and cons of these different things, and you know, what's going to suit you better for your lifestyle with any therapy. And that's the importance of the active surveillance when we can. You know, there's we're trying to minimize those small but real risks. And if we're going to risk those, make sure we do it on the higher risk patients. So hopefully in your case, with one of the things they found is reconditioning, getting physically active, especially with some modest weights, that's as effective actually as the aerobic type things. And that can, you know, really help turn around some of that that loss of spunk you may be feeling.
Okay. Well, Dr. Cooley, I thank you so much for taking time. Was that pctrf.org?
pctrf.org, that's right.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we can visit again.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Greg Cooley, a clinical associate professor in the Department of Human Oncology at the UW Health. Again, that site, we'll post it up on our Facebook page. It's pctrf.org, and I'm sure Jill Nadeau will get that up. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the science, the politics, and the human costs of developing vaccine, a very interesting book written by Meredith Wadman. That next here on the Ideas Network.